If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Lower.com, Equal Housing Lender, MLS 112-4061.
Listening, and you will listen to much of this hour, new CD called Stan Getz, Moments in Time. My guest, and I've been trying to get him on for a long time, Michael Binder is a doctor. He is a doctor with, for how many years now, Michael?
Almost 25.
You write something very interesting in the preface. When I went into the field of psychiatry, I questioned the need for psychotropic drugs. Nearly a decade of clinical experience convinced me that psychotropic medication was not only important, but in some cases an essential part of treatment. The name of the book, ladies and gentlemen, is Am I Depressed or Am I Bipolar? That is a question that seriously bedevils me occasionally. And I think it probably bedevils anybody who suffers from depression. Could you define depression for me?
Yes,
I know,
sir.
It's hard. They're all, after reading your book, they're all different levels of it. They're all different causes for it. Could you give me a sort of rough, broad definition of what depression is?
The best way to answer that is to start out with what you said originally, which was that I wanted to approach the field without using any medications.
Right.
When I first went into psychiatry, and it took me
Let me stop you and ask you, went to the University of Chicago and the Pritzker School of Medicine. Why did you choose? I'm ever fascinated by why doctors choose certain specialties. Psychiatry takes longer study. Why psychiatry?
Yes, that's true. It does. Well, I really liked working with people, and I found that in the other areas, I was more of a technician than I was really getting to know a person and working intimately with them.
Interesting. Yeah. And you committed then to this cause. And after,
yes.
But you thought to yourself, well, I don't want to be a technician. I don't want to prescribe a lot of drugs. And after a while, you're like, well.
Well, what happened was it took me about 10 years in practice to come to realize that I was missing the anatomy. And when I finally figured out what was going on in the mind, I came to realize that the brain and the mind are not the same.
Very interesting. Do you believe in the soul?
Yes.
That's part of this, is it not?
Absolutely.
Expand on that a little bit.
Well, the soul can also be thought about as the mind, the psyche, or the head of the spirit. These are all terms that are used to really talk about the same thing. But essentially the mind, or the soul, in my mind, it's an energy body, and it emits energies consistent with our thoughts and feelings.
Let's take an example. If someone, your earliest patients, would come to you, how?
With all types of different disorders. They may have had depression,
recommended
anxiety.
To come to you by another physician, generally their own personal physician or something.
Either that, or they might go to a psychiatrist as a first line.
The stigma, which still exists and which you address in your book, and I think this is a huge problem. I think it's a huge problem with alcoholism. I think it's a huge problem with drug addiction. Because people do not want to admit to having a human failing. That stigma is very heavy still, is it not?
It absolutely is. And a lot of work needs to be done still, even to this day, to destigmatize mental illness. And in defining the anatomy of the emotional system, we can go a long way to destigmatizing mental illness because the mind and the brain are different. And what happens is that the mind does emit energies to the brain, and it communicates with the brain.
Okay.
But the brain is just the transducer. It converts the subtle mental energies into electrical signals. that are then passed down the spinal cord through the peripheral nerves to the muscles and the parts of the body so that you can walk and talk and do all the things you do.
Right.
So actually the emotional system has two components, the mind and the brain.
But don't signals, and you address this in here, don't signals get confused during this whole thing? Because the way you're describing it, it would be kind of a simple thing that the mind sends to the brain and the brain says, you know, we're fine. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
The signals get confused, and that's when problems arise.
Let me define that.
Please.
It's when the neurons of the brain become hyperactive that the problems in mental health begin.
Why do they become hyperactive? One of the I told you when I first met you out there, I said, your book is fascinating, and I mean this, ladies and gentlemen. Am I depressed or am I bipolar? Which is a question that Dr. Michael Binder has probably been asked thousands of times. But the genetic predisposition to being bipolar is the thing that really scared me, because I don't want to diagnose my late mother, but this might have been an undiagnosed trouble for her. But back to these signals getting all crossed up.
I found from many areas of evidence that individuals are born with hyperactive neurons.
Okay. So it is, there is some genetic.
It is genetic.
Yeah.
It is genetic. And to give you an analogy of what I think is going on is that if you compared the brain to a beehive, in which the neurons, the tiny electrical cells that relay messages back and forth across the brain.
Yeah.
If you compare those neurons to bees in a beehive, some people are born with a brain that is like a beehive that is a northern, like northern bees. They're docile, they're calmer bees. And others are born with a brain that are like wild African bees. Now, as long as the two hives remain undisturbed, you cannot tell which one hive from another.
Wow.
But it's when the stresses in life start getting stirred up, is like throwing stones at the beehive. Then you see which person has which bees.
Fascinating. And it is fascinating. I'm glad you're going to be here for this. Dan, do we take a break at 27? I'm sitting here, and I will be sitting here for the rest of this hour with Dr. Michael Binder. You practice now in Glenview?
In Highland Park, at Highland Park Hospital.
What do I know? Highland Park Hospital. You went to the University of Chicago. That's all I know. And you worked in Waukesha for a while, right?
Yes, for 15 years.
Yeah. You were the head of, was it at a hospital?
Yes.
Head of psychiatry?
Yes, sir.
Wow. You don't have to call me sir. We're friends now. We'll take a break and come back and get further into this fascinating. Just, it's a great title for a book, Am I Depressed or Am I Bipolar? Because that is a crucial, there's a huge difference between those two, is there not? Huge and crucial difference between those two.
That's what I used to think, but they're on a continuum is what I found.
I know, very interesting. I'm going to read this list of some, we'll be right back. We'll be right back, then we'll get some news, and then Dr. Binder and I will continue on. It's the calming sounds of Stan Getz from a CD called Stan Getz Moments in Time. My guest and now friend is Dr. Michael Binder, the author of Am I Depressed or Am I Bipolar? In the form of a question. The subtitle is Help Your Doctor Make the Right Diagnosis and Choose the Right Treatment for You. Michael, this is written for the layperson. Is it not?
Yes.
I mean, I read it and I understand it. And if that happens, anybody could understand it. And I think it's an important book, because not only were we talking about the stigmatization of mental disease of all sorts, but the whole notion, especially with let's say teenagers and younger people who have been told all their lives, because that's what their parents were told, well, you're depressed, you'll get over it. You'll get over it. Basically, the diagnosis is snap out of it, right?
Yes.
And that's dangerous, is it not?
Absolutely. Incorrect. Actually, I wrote this book for patients. I wrote it for patients so that they could better present their symptoms to their doctors to help get a more accurate diagnosis. And there's statistics on this, these bipolar spectrum disorders are that it takes an average of 10 years seeing various doctors to get an accurate diagnosis.
Are you kidding? Why? Because many doctors don't
Patients typically do not describe their symptoms precisely enough to help the doctor come to the right conclusion.
Because they're embarrassed in some cases.
Let me give an example. When someone's cycling between highs and lows,
right,
they tend to go to the doctor when they're down.
Of course, yeah.
And in their mind, because their description is state-dependent, if doctor asks them, they typically will say, oh, I've been depressed for so many years. They won't talk about their highs.
Oh, how interesting is that? Yeah.
So then they're misdiagnosed with unipolar depression and given antidepressants. It's amazing how long it can take for these people to be diagnosed. And I've seen people that went 40 years to different people all around the country and were not properly diagnosed.
When did, has bipolar disease been, it seems to me, and I, again, I'm certainly, as you well know, I'm no doctor, is bipolar, how long has bipolar, the diagnosis of bipolar disease existed?
Well, from the beginning of man, but we don't, of course, have records dating back thousands of years.
But I mean the definition of, you know, I think of autism as something that I don't know if you would have been diagnosed with autism 100 years ago, but now there's a spectrum and all this stuff with a more specialization. When would someone have been diagnosed with bipolar disease?
When we started to learn how to correct it, which was in the 1940s with the introduction of lithium.
Okay.
Once we saw that we had a drug that was converting these people into normalcy, then the medical profession started looking and saying, wait a minute, how do we diagnose this? Because now we know how to treat it.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. That's kind of scary. You treat something before you really know what it is and diagnose it? I mean, it was...
Medications in psychiatry have helped us elucidate what's actually going on with the brain. Because the brain's very hard to study. There's so many different circuits.
Well, as you describe, it's like a beehive. It's like a bunch of beehives up there,
with
right?
hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of circuits.
Wow. Yeah, you're right. Has technology been of any help?
We have imaging studies that are showing differences in metabolism in different areas of the brain. So we know more about how this computer is processing the sugars that we take into our diet.
Yeah.
And it's giving us an idea of what areas are metabolizing at different rates. But it's not precise enough yet to really be used diagnostically. We're beginning to have that technology, but clinical diagnosis remains the gold standard. And if you think about it, the way that these imaging studies are developed is by being related to clinical diagnoses. So it always comes down to having an accurate clinical diagnosis, and it will always be that way. Except that with these new studies, if we can use them diagnostically, then the younger students coming out of residency can use these tests to confirm a diagnosis, but they will never be as accurate as a physician who's had a lot of experience diagnosing them.
Well, as you were saying earlier, I think off air, and I'm going to bring this up again, is that with your experience, you've been almost 20 years at this, or maybe more than 20, around 20 years of this, right?
Yes.
Seeing patients, you have the ability with that experience to make a relatively quick diagnosis without
any tests, any blood tests, any brain scans, and I'm fortunate enough that almost all my patients have stuck with me for more than a decade. And so I can look back on my original diagnosis to see whether or not it was accurate.
And see what it was based on, too, correct?
Yes, what it was based on and whether or not it was accurate based on the patient's responses to the medications I used. And I would say in the last 15 years, I can't think of hardly a case that I misdiagnosed. Wow. Now, in my first 5 to 10 years in practice, I was misdiagnosing about 40%, I would say, of my patients. But with experience comes accuracy.
Sure.
Now, I wanted to get back to saying something about the hyperactive neurons because
that's fascinating.
In my mind, that's the basis of mental illness. And what I want to say is that this problem of hyperactive neurons is genetic. It's inherited. And a person has it from birth. People who are born with hyperactive neurons, this beehive that has bees that have a more irritable temperament, they don't handle stresses like people with normal active neurons. And that's the basis of mental illness.
That makes a lot of sense to me. That really does make a lot of sense to me.
Well, and they can't do anything about that because the brains that they have, they're born with those brains. It's like trying to do something about your height.
Yeah, right.
Or your eye color.
Well, what can they do about it? Can drugs help them somehow make the bees quiet down? Or
two things. If the neurons are not too hyperactive, they're mildly hyperactive.
Okay.
These people can usually deal with stresses by having a regular schedule, having an exercise routine, knowing how to de-stress, knowing how to avoid stressful situations, not working too many hours.
So these are lifestyle. These are lifestyle changes
for the people with mild hyperexcitability.
Gotcha.
But the ones that have a more severe hyperexcitability in their neuronal system, they ultimately will need medication to calm down the neurons. But that medication can make them normal. These people can become normal for the rest of their lives.
And happy.
Just like a normal person.
Wow. We got to take a break. You're going to be on for the rest of the hour. I want to get into, again, the book is called Am I Depressed or Am I Bipolar? Help your doctor make the right diagnosis and choose the right treatment for you. I got to believe there are millions, if not tens of millions, of people walking around totally undiagnosed. Is that right?
And inaccurately diagnosed.
Right. I want to get into this bipolarity in alcoholism and substance abuse because that I have seen that firsthand. We'll take a quick break, and I'll be back with Dr. Michael Binder. That, once again, for the last time tonight, Stan Getz, new CD called Moments in Time. Dr. Michael Binder has been a revelation to me. I mean, he makes sense not only in his book, Am I Depressed or Am I Bipolar? Help your doctor make the right diagnosis and choose the right treatment for you, but in his conversation, too. The book's fabulous, and it will be so enlightening to you. Well, I'm not telling you to buy it if you have, some kid who is acting crazy or something. Buy it to learn something. You write in here, Michael, clinical experience has shown that most persons who abuse alcohol and other drugs have an underlying psychiatric condition, most commonly a cyclic mood disorder. Their mood instability not only leads them into drugs, but also reinforces their use in drugs. You working in Highland Park must come across that kind of thing frequently. I know the whole North Shore, Nutria, and they're not all Nutria kids. They're not all bad kids, but I've known that problem to exist in that neighborhood. Why is that? Why? And again, these are really simple questions for a learned man, but is part of it to escape the buzzing bees, for instance?
Precisely. That's precisely right. And it should come as no surprise that alcohol has been and continues to be the most commonly abused drug because alcohol is an anticonvulsant.
What does that mean?
It means calms the brain down.
Anticonvulsant, okay.
You've heard of epilepsy seizure disorders?
Sure.
Well, we use anticonvulsants to treat those disorders. And what seizure disorders really are, it's hyperactive neurons, but in the motor systems that control the muscles. So we have a similar phenomenon happening here, but it's in the emotional systems. So all these people that have been drinking since antiquity, they're smarter than we think they are, because they have found their own way of calming down their neurons.
Well, their own way to self-medicate, and it may not. And the other thing about alcohol is you cannot, you know, maybe if you were some kind of genius, you could control the intake, but that's the downside of that. You might be able to do it for a minute, but you're not, that in the long run, that's not going to help.
The problem with alcohol in the treatment of this is that it's short-acting and it has withdrawal. So as the alcohol goes into the blood, it actually calms down the brain, which has a soothing effect, and that's why people do it. The problem is it has to be metabolized out of your system, and as it's metabolized out of the system, the neurons become more hyperactive than they were. So there's a rebound hyperexcitability, which causes a person to want to have another drink.
Mm.
And so they become alcoholics.
Life's tough. Again, this is not my diagnosis, but life is tough. You write here in the book, the problem of recognition, of recognizing this disease, is threefold. First, and we've touched on this, is the stigma of mental illness. Second is the failure to recognize symptoms. And third is a lack of education about the causes and available treatments. Psychiatric illness, as opposed to almost every other kind of medical illness, does cause that stigma where people will not seek help.
That's because people tend to confuse the mind with the brain.
Yeah, we talked about that.
People act as if all a person's problems are in their mind. And so because the mind is under our control, they say it's under your control. You should be able to pick yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yeah.
But what they're not recognizing is the anatomy, that part of the emotional system is governed by the brain, because the brain sends the mind electrical messages all the time, which can be thoughts and feelings. And some of them can be inappropriate, or they can magnify normal feelings. And that's a particular problem if the neurons are hyperactive.
Wow. How many patients do you have?
Thousands.
How often do you see? I'm sure it varies. This is, I'm trying to generalize this whole thing, but have you had patients for 20 years?
Yes. I have patients that I still have from maybe my first few years of practice, some that were 13 when I saw them, and now they're in their 20s and 30s. And
at that point, they're coming in obviously many of their problems have been ameliorated and not, if not fixed for good, at least under control. Do they come in then after all that time for kind of checkups?
Typically, if they're on medication, they might come in once every 3 to 6 months, sometimes once a year. Some people don't come in but every few years.
Wow.
They can get refills. They might call me once a year, and I just call in a refill with a year's worth of refills for them.
Yeah.
But they keep touch, they keep contact, and when problems come and happen in their life and they want to have some feedback or some guidance with the problems, they might come in to see me. But the most important thing to understand is that these medicines, we call them anticonvulsants.
Yeah.
They are very safe. They're not addicting. They're not harmful to the body. And they calm down the neurons and make them normal active. And the problem of the brain hyperexcitability is corrected. And they can start handling their problems like a normal person. They don't even need psychotherapy.
Wow. Wow. You also write in here another thing that intrigued me. For some, the use of the psychotropic medication also raises important spiritual and religious questions. Meaning what?
Meaning,
I've read the chapter, but I want you to explain.
People who have an religious orientation or a faith base sometimes think, well, if I take medicine, does that mean that I'm not relying on my faith? And I remember back when I was thinking about going to medical school and I was working as a chaplain's aide, I asked Father Trainer, I said, Father Trainer, you know, I'm thinking I want to go to medical school, but if we can pray and through faith ask God to heal us, why would I want to become a physician and interfere with that process? And he said, well, actually, God works through people. He works through doctors and nurses.
Huh.
So in actuality, he said, if you go into the field of medicine and you care, you truly care for your patients, you will be helping him. You will be his hands on earth. And that's what convinced me to go to medical school.
Wow. That's some conversation, man. That is some conversation mm-hmm. you had with him.
Mm-hmm.
Are you, having devoted, and we talked at the very beginning of this interview, and thank you again for coming in and letting me read your book. You decided to get into psychiatry for, I think, all the right reasons. Has it been a satisfying for you?
It must
to see someone who is in the same way that it's someone who is physically damaged.
Seeing a person who has spent their adolescence, their adult life, struggling with anxiety, depression, trouble sleeping, losing jobs, and in a matter of 1 week, turning that all around, that's amazing. And it speaks to the importance of the brain in contributing to this problem. And that's another reason why I want to emphasize that one should not feel weak or one should not feel like they're a spiritual failure if they go in for treatment, because this is typically, in many cases, or even most cases, as physical as having high blood pressure mm-hmm. or having diabetes.
Yeah.
And we should be helping ourselves and allowing doctors to help us.
I agree.
If we can.
Yeah.
It's part of taking responsibility.
Well spoken. And part of, well, you have gone a long way, I think, to anybody who's listening, to destigmatizing the whole notion of a psychiatrist. You sound like the best psychiatrist in America. It'd be like, well, I'd go to you in the same way if I needed a haircut. I'd go to Colin of London, which is run by, you should go. I don't go to Colin of London because I go to Mr. Barber, who's a friend of Colin of London. But Colin of London, a hair salon on Oak Street run by your sister, Lisa, and your mom, Cleo, is a great, great place. I'm going to have you back on. I want to talk sometime about very, very, very kinds of specific kinds of problems, especially when they manifest themselves in news stories, you know, because you will always hear about, you know, and I don't want you to diagnose someone off a news story, but this is really, really an issue of our times now, because I think the ways in which people can get depressed, although it is genetic, but I think these stressors that you talked about influencing that beehive that's in there and throwing bricks at it are exponentially increasing.
That's absolutely true. And with it, the incidence of substance abuse,
yep.
of crime, of people being put in jail.
Yep.
Yes.
You've been not only enlightening, you've been a revelation to me. The book, and you can get it on Amazon or any of these other online bookselling sites, is Am I Depressed or Am I Bipolar? Help your doctor make the right diagnosis and choose the right treatment for you. This has really been a revelation. Thank you, Dr. Michael Binder, and Lisa and Cleo and everybody else in your lovely family.